Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today, we present another program from our 2018 Champlain Institute series, hosted by College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor. Today's program features Ted Widmer, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. He joins William Thorndike to tackle an old question: is democracy failing? The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and the program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to find this program at your convenience, and you can access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. And now, introducing our speaker today is David Hackett Fisher, Professor of History at Brandeis University.
And it's my happy task to introduce Ted Widmer. I did a little research on Ted Widmer, and when he published one of his recent books, one of the Providence newspapers did a piece on him and said, somebody should write a book about Ted Widmer. And he has had a most extraordinary life. He and many of our other friends here have been working very closely together. Ted did all of his graduate work and undergraduate work at Harvard, all three of his degrees. But at the same time, he was always engaged outside the university's academic life. As an undergraduate, he was, some people said he majored in the Harvard Lampoon. And he is today a trustee of the Lampoon Society. After he got his doctorate at Harvard, he was invited to join the faculty teaching history and lit. And this, from 1993-1997, coincided exactly with his time as a lead guitar and vocalist on a hard rock band in Boston for 4 years. In 1997, he left both Harvard and the rock band and went to the White House as a special assistant to Bill Clinton. And then in 2001, back into academe at Washington College in Maryland, where he established a major center for research in American history, which is flourishing today. He then became director of the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University and made it into a great center, not only of rare books and collections, but of service to people who use the books. And while he was there, just on the side, he led an international effort to rebuild libraries and schools in Haiti after the earthquakes of 2010. In 2012, he was back in Washington, this time as special assistant to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, which was a job that I think lasted to 2013. Through it all, he published very actively. He has a gift, and a rare one, for works of deep scholarship that people actually like to read. Much of it is about the history of democracy on subjects closely linked to the theme of this session. His dissertation was called Young America. Its subtitle was The Flowering of Democracy in New York City. And it won major prizes and is still in print. He wrote a biography of Martin Van Buren, did larger works, one called The Ark of Liberties, which is a history of American foreign policy in a democracy. He did another history of presidential campaigns with Alan Brinkley, again on democratic politics. He did two volumes on presidential rhetoric in American history. One of his most interesting publications was co-edited with Caroline Kennedy, and it's called Listening In. It includes the secret White House tapes of President John Kennedy, reproduced with the book on compact discs. And experts on the Kennedy administration said the best way to understand this man in American history is to read that book and to listen to those tapes which bring him alive. They're available on Amazon Books and frequently sell out. Ted's subject today is democracy failing. And it has a double importance as a question not only of current concern, but also as one of the very oldest, maybe one could say the oldest of our major historical problems. It was framed by Aristotle in the 4th century BC. With his students, Aristotle made a study of democracy in 158 Greek city-states. Only the conclusion to his book survives, at least I thought that was the case. That's what's published as Aristotle's Politics. It's a major book in its own right. And I've just found that one of the city studies of those 158, which happens to be a study of Athens, survives in a Greek papyrus copy, and is just beginning to be examined. Aristotle and his students found that democracy was tried in most city-states, and they also found that sooner or later it failed everywhere, absolutely everywhere. But they also found that aristocracy failed everywhere, and they found that monarchy failed everywhere. And from this record of total failure, they invented a way to success, which was that idea of a mixed and or balanced government, which had elements of democracy, aristocracy, and monarchy all combined. And it became the central idea in so much of political theory in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. It was taken up amongst the Romans by Livy, and then Machiavelli wrote his most important book, not The Prince, but what he called his discourses on Livy, Livy discoursing on Aristotle on the subject of this mixed and balanced government. John Adams, in the midst of doing other things on the eve of the American Revolution, took the time to teach himself Italian so he could read Machiavelli's discourses. And put that idea to work in a little essay that Adams called an Essay on Government, written at the request of the delegation of the Continental Congress from North Carolina on how to write a constitution, how to found a free society. And it was based on that Aristotelian idea of mixed and balanced government. It went into Adams's a constitution of Massachusetts and Maine, which endured. It is today the oldest constitution in continuous use in the world today, based on that idea. These mixed and balanced systems ran into another problem when they suddenly multiplied in the 20th century. And then we had a problem not merely of failure and not only of democracy or these other pure types, but a failure of these mixed governments with an element of democracy in them. And it was a new kind of epidemic failure. The first epidemic was from the period of the Treaty of Versailles through into the 1930s. In 1932, something like 26 governments in Europe had been redesigned with this mixed and balanced government with democratic elections. By 1941, only two of them survived, only two. All the rest had been destroyed either by conquest from without or by chaos within. Then came another round that we have been living through, when these governments began to multiply once again after the World War II, after the fall of the Soviet Union. And then in our own time, are they failing once more? Are we getting another wave of epidemic failures in democracy, of troubles with this democratic element, not merely in the United States, but around the world? Or is it another turn of the wheel of this Aristotelian wheel? And that's the business that's before our two speakers. So let me invite Ted Widmer to the stage, and also with him, Will Thorndike. I was not assigned to introduce Will because he needs no introduction. I would only say I could introduce him not only as a colleague, a friend of many people in this room, a strong friend of this college, but also as a historian for a wonderful piece that he was working on last summer here on the island on Benjamin Franklin, and now it's out. It's been published in a short version, I hope to be followed by longer ones, on Benjamin Franklin as a man who has a great success in business and then went on to many things, a career that sounds familiar to those who know our interlocutor. So let me invite both of you up to the stage today and continue.
Thanks so much. That was beautiful. Thank you. I just want to say it's completely fun to be up here with Ted, and it's just a great treat. And Ted, this week has been, he's just been sort of an amazing jack of all trades. He's been a moderator, he's been in my seat, he's been an introducer, he's been a key curator behind all of this, and he finally gets his own session today, which is great fun. And thanks, David and Darren, for those excellent introductions. You know, as David said, Ted sort of stands out in our lineup of speakers for the week by virtue of being a historian. And within the world of historians, he stands out a bit because he's spent, as David said in his introduction, he spent a chunk of his career as a practitioner, sort of in the arena, you know, in the Clinton White House and in the Hillary Clinton State Department and a range of other advisory roles, including a current one with Andrew Cuomo. So, you know, Tony Blinken on Tuesday night had this very memorable phrase where he sort of paraphrased that quote about, you know, those who ignore history are bound to retweet it, right? sort of his phrasing. And I think it's true that it, you know, that at exceptionally heated times like this one, that context, sort of the longer, you know, the longer view can be most valuable and important. And so that's sort of the where we're gonna focus our time this morning. We're gonna start with the US, since that's where a lot of Ted's scholarship has been, and then we're gonna sort of move out in concentric circles beyond our borders. To start us off down that sort of longer path, are there periods in US history that you think offer sort of the closest parallels to the current time?
Great question. And let me also thank Will, who does so much all year long for COA, but he and I don't think you know this, we've been friends since about 1982 or 83. But to your question, there certainly are parallels. There's been a fair amount of talk in the news about our similarities to the year 1968, exactly 50 years ago. We often think in terms of our memory of something that happened 50 years ago or 100 years ago, but in this case, there's some truth to it. We were a divided country in 68, and we are again today. We were more divided generationally, I think, in 68 than now, but the two parties were certainly hostile toward each other, as they are now, and there were signs of a culture that was spinning out of control. Happy to say we don't share something with 68, the two assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, but there was a feeling that the country had lost its direction. And I've done a little bit of work in some public writing. The New York Times is trying to pay attention to the late 60s, and they have been publishing quite a few articles on 1967 and 1968. I did one a couple months ago about Robert Kennedy and his very unusual presidential campaign, and I'm about to do one. Richard Nixon's speech to the Republican convention was on August 8th, 1968. I'm gonna try to write something for the Times on that date. And it's a very interesting speech. It includes some language that we might recognize as similar to President Trump's about us versus them, and real Americans versus all these complaining people you see in the streets. But reading it, it's really quite muted compared to the level of vitriol you get today, you know, almost on a daily basis from the White House. So it is different. I'm also finishing a book that got a little longer than I meant it to. That's a liability of this profession, but it's about Abraham Lincoln just before becoming president. So only 12 days in his life, in February of 1861, when he gets on a train in Illinois to go to Washington to become the president. And I had really good conversations with Jamie McCown of the COA faculty, who's working in a very similar time in Lincoln's life. And Lincoln is dealing not only with the problem of slavery, which is mainly how we remember the Civil War, but there was a real breakdown in democratic norms also. In the late 1850s, the party system was changing very rapidly, and there was a lot of distrust toward the Supreme Court, as there is today. There was a feeling, a lot of suspicion of the executive, and in Congress, distrust of the media, as there is today. So as Lincoln is taking his train to become president, he's wrestling with a lot of familiar problems, and it's fascinating.
That's great, thank you. So David sort of gave the longitudinal view of democracy and, you know, sort of its fragility over time. So just at a very high level, what do you think are the two or three greatest threats to democracy as a model, as a system?
Well, historically, democracy has not been very fast to respond to very well-organized ideologies supported by big militaries. So when Hitler rose in Germany in the 1930s and launched all the activities that led to World War II, the U.S. was not very fast at responding and made a lot of mistakes in its own domestic politics, but of course finally got up to speed and responded with incredible strength and defeated Hitler and his allies. We also, it felt to us that we were a little slow in the late 1940s and the 1950s to respond to Russian communism, which was both an ideology but also a specific nation. And when China also went communist, there were a lot of years where American politicians bewailed the slowness of democracy to respond. And one of the ways John F. Kennedy was elected in 1960 was by saying there were all kinds of gaps between our performance and Russia's. And it is true that we argue a lot among ourselves, and we argue especially about military budgets, and when there's an organized enemy, we can feel sluggish. The term Islamic fascism was used a fair amount in the aftermath of 9/11. I didn't think that was a great historic parallel, because Islamic terrorism is not supported by a large state with a large economy with a large military the way fascism was, so I don't like that phrase. But I think there are other historic threats that we really should pay attention to that are still with us. I don't see a large state actor. We certainly have problems with Russia. I don't think Russia is about to invade us or probably anyone soon. But we've wrestled since the beginning of our history, as all of us know, with the problem of racism, which is not only a problem of harsh treatment one racial group toward another, but it really is a flaw in a democratic system. That the fundamental premise of democracy is that all people share in the use of power. It's government of the people, by the people, for the people. So you need to include all people. And that has been very difficult for all democracies, and it's been very difficult for us. And you still see that tension in the air in Charlottesville a year ago. And it might add a new threat that I don't see so much in earlier episodes, but I might call it inattention. There's something going on that I want to try to be specific about. The rise of the internet, which is one of the great features of our lifetimes, incredibly important. And we were, you know, kind of dimly aware that something big was happening in the 90s when we were, Tony and I were speechwriters in the White House, but I don't think any of us anticipated the might of the internet to shape our lives and even more the lives of our children. And we mostly wander around in a kind of internet fog in which we think, fog is a good metaphor for this morning. We just think it's all great. We check our email. I was just checking it. We read the New York Times or whatever newspapers we read. And I'm not even on social media, but most people are. And yet it's bringing damage to us also. And we see it in so many things to pay attention to, and that is a rising problem for young people. And I'm still in the business of teaching young people. But also we've seen the rise of powerful and very negative political trends that are increasing the polarization on both sides. And I think we need to figure out how to regulate this incredibly powerful source of information. I can maybe get more specific about ideas later. I don't want to answer for too long, but I'm worried about inattention. I think we need to figure out how to pay focused attention to democratic practices. And what are they, and how can we regain our skill at them?
So last year, our curator, Jeff Rosen, spoke of the spread of presidential power, sort of Schlesinger's idea of the imperial presidency as something that the framers didn't fully contemplate, and that represented a potential risk to democracy. So this next series of questions, we're going to disappear briefly down a presidential power rabbit hole, but I promise we'll come back up the other side. But what do you think of that? What do you think of that concept as of?
That was a great book, The Imperial Presidency by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and he argued that the presidency, just as you said, had grown much more powerful than the founders anticipated. They needed to make it more powerful than it had been. There is no presidency in the early 1780s. There is a country, there's the United States of America, but there's no president until George Washington wins first election, becomes president in 1789, 2 years after the Constitution. They knew they were adding something very strong into the system that had not been there before, but they put all of these checks upon the presidency, including the three branches and Congress's right to curtail the executive in a variety of ways. But they didn't anticipate, no one could have anticipated what happened. So Andrew Jackson increases a lot of executive power during his presidency, Abraham Lincoln even more so. When presidents have wars to fight, inevitably they gain a great deal of power. In the 20th century, no one more than Franklin Roosevelt, who both by the length of his presidency, but by the urgency of fighting, leading a global war, vastly expanded the presidency. And that changed our democracy. It put a lot of the power to initiate legislation stayed with the president after Franklin Roosevelt. And it was probably healthier in a lot of ways to have Congress more powerful vis-a-vis the presidency than it was for most of the last 60 years. And now there's a very interesting conversation beginning among a lot of historians and also people who are more on the left side of the aisle that states' rights, historically we hear that phrase, we think of George Wallace in the 1960s and Southern governors resisting federal pressure to integrate. And states' rights was a kind of code word for keeping public schools separated racially. But now states' rights might become a way to talk about democratic states resisting pressure from the Trump administration in a variety of ways, including climate. There are really specific kinds of actions states can take. California, in fact, which is huge, California has 40 million people. Its laws require that automobiles have a certain level of efficiency. And President Trump is trying to eliminate fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. But California won't accept that. So we're getting in a situation kind of like what Abraham Lincoln dealt with and what presidents in the 50s and 60s dealt with, of governors who don't want to do what presidents are telling them to do. But now liberals are going to be on the side of California, and I think New York is going to be right there too. So if you have New York and California, that's 60 million people. That's a lot of people. And so I hope that leads to progressive, thoughtful kinds of democratic exchanges. I'm not sure that will be the case.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Ted Widmer is speaking at the annual Champlain Institute in Bar Harbor, discussing factors that help or harm democracy in the 21st century.
So in the spirit of extreme centrism that Neil Katyal spoke about on Monday night, when you and I were in college, there was a largely negative consensus view of Ronald Reagan as a president. And he's now widely considered to be one of our more effective presidents. So is it possible that we are misassessing our current president? And what are his strengths in your mind?
Well, that's a great question. And I think it's good for liberals, which I mostly am, although I'm a pretty centrist in a lot of ways too. But it's important for liberals to ask questions like that. We're in such an unprecedented situation that I think we need to look at ourselves and our own shortcomings constantly, but maybe not to focus on them all the time. Because I just read a wonderful book by Schlesinger mentioned earlier called The Vital Center. It's a book he wrote in, I think, 1947, and he said, he was pretty centrist too, he said, what we need is a fighting faith in freedom in our system. We need to not be back on our heels, but we need to be focused about what actually makes democracy work and what makes the United States great. And so we don't want to lose confidence. But I want to agree with you. I feel like I was wrong in a lot of ways about Ronald Reagan. I mostly did not approve of him when he was president. It was a kind of immature disapproval, the way young people are. Partly I was worried I would be sent into a war. I thought I'd be drafted, and obviously wasn't. And I just felt sort of culturally estranged from him, but I do think he did great work to make the American people feel confident in themselves. He was a great salesman of America and of democracy, and he gave very beautiful speeches. A speech at the dedication of the Statue of Liberty, the centennial, the unbelievably beautiful speech the day of the Challenger disaster, which is, you know, one of the most beautiful presidential speeches of my lifetime. And I appreciated also he did wonderful work to lower tensions with the Soviet Union near the end of his presidency, and nearly accomplished a great reduction in nuclear weapons at Reykjavik that would have been really historic. I think there were things he didn't pay enough attention to, and a lot of the income inequality that is a big problem in our democracy today, that really got going in the 1980s under his presidency, and there were specific reasons that it did. And one great feature of the bipartisan consensus on democracy in the 1940s and 50s and 60s was that we didn't want too much income inequality. And under Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, he mainly kept all of the New Deal programs in place throughout the 50s. One reason I think he really was a great president. About Trump.
The way I would frame that is, what are his strengths in your mind, and who's his closest historic parallel?
There are real ones, and so that's where I think we need to pay close attention. He basically blew away his Republican competition. He was up against, I think, 16 other Republicans. So 17 in all, and he just blew them away. No one was really that close. So there are remarkable political strengths in Donald Trump. And occasionally he would show great courage in adopting a political opinion that was wildly at odds with the other Republicans. And I remember one specifically in a debate, he was the only one out of 17 to say the Iraq War was a disaster. So he's an unorthodox guy, and what's so strange right now is I don't feel he's even that much of a natural Republican. He's not a free trader. The Republican Party stood for free trade forever. The Republican Party was always more focused on the threat from Russia than the Democratic Party. And he's less focused on that threat than anyone in the United States. But he is an independent thinker, and he's a natural politician. He has great energy. He may not speak in beautiful cadences the way I like to hear. I mean, I would give Ronald Reagan credit for speaking beautifully. These are ugly speeches with small words. Scholars of rhetoric have studied how small his vocabulary is. I mean, it's about 80 words, and you just always hear, we are doing an amazing, amazing job. This is great. It's just, you know, these words that an 8-year-old could be using. But he's a natural. He gets up and talks forever. He can just go to a rally, Montana, Kentucky, you know, all the places he feels comfortable speaking. He will never do this where he doesn't feel comfortable, but he will talk for 90 minutes with no notes in front of him, and he'll give the people he wants to speak to everything they want. And so he's physically strong, and he's confident, and I mean, his confidence is kind of a source of concern because he's very willing to run roughshod over all of the norms of Washington, which he is doing. My disappointment at present is that the Republican Party has been so supine, and that's a good word. That's a complicated word that Senator Jeff Flake used to describe his own party. So we're just supine. We just do whatever this guy wants. And in 1968, this is a difference. The Democratic Party was really resisting Lyndon Johnson quite a lot. Jim Lowenstein worked for Senator Fulbright of Arkansas. Fulbright was really saying, we're not going to give you the funding for the Vietnam War anymore. And it would be great to see Republican senators standing up for democracy against a Republican president. And I have actually voted for Republicans a couple times in my life, and I fear that Donald Trump is destroying the great party. I mean, we will see how this all turns out, but we need a two-party system with two good parties, and right now it's not quite like that.
If you had to pick a historic parallel, who would it be?
He's unprecedented, but in the amount of news he generates all the time, he reminds me a little bit of when Teddy Roosevelt came into the presidency, which he did through an assassination. Just suddenly the energy level really picked up, and newspaper articles were always writing about Teddy Roosevelt. And our national media is completely obsessed with Donald Trump, and it is in many ways empowering him. Even the media that is against Trump, and a lot of the media is against Trump, but in her rant at the Correspondents' Dinner, the comedian Michelle Wolf said, you act like you hate him, but you actually love him. She said it's like a dystopian middle school crush where you think you're mad at this swaggering bully, but you actually have a crush on him. And I sometimes feel like every day in the New York Times and the Washington Post, there are more articles than I can read. There are a dozen articles every day on some misdeed of Donald Trump. And with the Teddy Roosevelt coverage, it was mostly positive. And with the media right now, it's mostly negative. But that feeling of constant attention, a surge in interest, feels a little bit like the Roosevelt presidency.
Okay, so we're going to broaden out our focus a little bit. And on a hike the other day, Door Ladder Trail, actually, and very appropriately for our being here at COA, you mentioned the historic importance of the Atlantic Charter for U.S. foreign policy and the spread of democracy globally. Can you talk a little bit about its significance and maybe then relevance now?
You saw me limping when I came onto the stage, just because if you stay at Will's house, as I have been, you are obligated to go on a punishing hike every day for about 3 hours. And most historians I know, including me, are not in very good shape. So I've earned my...
Ted's done very well.
Yeah, done very well. Anyway, we were looking out over the Atlantic, and it reminded me of this really important document that I think has faded somewhat from public view called the Atlantic Charter. It was a document that was signed, it was actually a telegram. There is no signed thing like the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. It was a telegram that Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt wrote together and sent out to the world in August 1941. And they put a dateline at the top. They said somewhere in the Atlantic. No one knew where they were. Champlain would have appreciated that. But they were off Newfoundland on two naval vessels. And it was an amazing document, both because it really united the UK and the US. It was the beginning, I would say, of the special relationship. It listed a number of concrete aims. The US was not yet in World War II. We were putting our thumb on the scale for England, but we definitely were not in the war. But it was a kind of treaty document between Churchill and FDR about the things we were fighting for. And they listed a number of democratic principles, including the right of all peoples on earth to live under governments of their own choosing, which was an incredibly important statement to put out to the world at a very dark moment in human history. So right away, they telegraphed literally to the world that this was going to be a fight for democracy, which meant that if the Allied powers won, which they did, thank God, they would have to build democracy around the world. And these were incredibly important thoughts to express. And what was fascinating about that document was that Winston Churchill, although very popular still, and for many good reasons, was not a natural Democrat. He was very democratic in some ways. He was great at arguing in Parliament, as few prime ministers ever have been. But he did not really want all people on earth to live under governments of their own choosing. And a lot of people heard those words, including Nelson Mandela in South Africa, and Gandhi in India, and leaders of Burma and all the British countries in Africa. Basically, the British Empire probably began to fall apart at that moment. And that was important, and that was, I think, good for human history. It was certainly good for democracy. But this is where you get into a gray zone, where some people don't think that was great for human history and for democracy.
That's great. So Neil and Jamie the other night discussed the question of whether and how quickly norms can bounce back. You know, how resilient democracy is. So what's your view on that?
We are in some trouble. I think there are a lot of incredibly negative assessments you can read in the media. And then there are these sort of confusing books that come out also that say how great everything is. There's a book by Steven Pinker called Enlightenment Now that argues that human health has never been better. Poverty has been reduced steadily for the last 40 years. We haven't seen major wars. We haven't seen sort of state versus state wars on a major level for a long time. Those are fantastic developments, but I don't feel comforted by his book at all. I think we're seeing steadily, month by month, the erosion of democratic norms. You used a word, we were talking about it, and Will used the word memory foam. Was that it? When there's special kinds of mattresses that hold your body's position, and we want memory foam. We want to sort of stay in our comfortable democratic set of feelings, and I'm worried that we're getting a new mattress. Remember Scott Pruitt, one of his many minor acts of corruption? He was trying to get used mattresses from the Trump Hotel in Washington. Anyway, Freedom House is a great NGO. You can all go on their website, and they track democratic norms around the world. And in 2018, they put out an alarming report that said democracy is eroding in 71 countries out of about 200. It's improving in 35, but it's getting worse in 71, and the trend is accelerating. So democracy is getting worse in about twice as many countries as it's getting better. And then a big headline in the report was, the United States of America is no longer the world's model of democracy. And that's a very alarming fact for us to contemplate, whether we are Republican or Democrat. And because with Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill in 1941, the message was the U.S. is the world's guardian of democracy. It was a big role to take on, and some people would say we don't want that role. And I believe President Trump would himself say we do not want the role of the world's guardian of democracy. And I think there's some Democrats who would agree, and there's some Republicans who would agree, but I think there's a broad center of both in politics, but even more importantly, in the American people themselves that want the United States to stand up for what is right in the world. And that's a core part of what democracy is. Yes, it is a system of checks and balances that curtails too much power in various parts of our society, but it's also an ethical system. And here's where I think it gets hard to be specific. We want to treat each other well. We want to live peacefully. We want to respect the other people who don't agree with our political opinions. We want to accept elections that we lose. We want term limits on our leaders. We want all of those things, and those are basically about trust of others. And I think globally and domestically, trust is really eroding a lot. We don't like each other very much, and that is a big problem for democracy.
So let's flash forward. It's 2030. What are the three things that you would hope we had done to protect democracy globally?
Great question.
Between today and 2030, in that interim.
Well, as you can tell, I'm sure, from the way I'm talking, I would like a future president, and I hope in 2030 it is no longer President Donald Trump. There is a trend that we should pay close attention to, an anti-democratic trend. I don't think it will happen here. That's, you know, the Sinclair Lewis book, It Could Happen Here, is that the title? But there's a trend we've seen in Turkey, we've seen in China, we've seen in Russia, where there were term limits on presidents and legislatures that kept presidents in check. And in earlier this year, China's legislature just said, you know what, we don't really care. You're going to be Premier Xi is going to be our premier for life. That's okay. And do you remember Vladimir Putin briefly stepped down from the leadership of Russia and then came back? That was because there was a time about 10 years ago where even he felt democratic norms required him to leave office. We all knew it was a kind of fig leaf, but he did do it, and then he came back. And then Turkey, the same thing. Turkey's just radically rewritten its political rules so that Erdogan is in power forever, as long as he wants to be, it feels like. And that was an aside, but in 2030, I hope we have a new president from either party who restores the role of the U.S. as the guardian of the morals of the world, the ethical principles that democracy also stands up for. I hope specifically that the U.S. and China are on a, that they have a healthy relationship. I'm not under any illusions that I think it will be perfect, but I think it has been a pretty good relationship now for about 30 years. As Susan Rice said, we are competitors, but then as she also said, we are not adversaries. We are an adversary of Russia, but we are not of China. And with China's inevitable growing power, economically, militarily, politically in the world, it'll be a much better world if we are working together for stability instead of really at loggerheads. So I hope the U.S. and China have figured out, China is not a democracy, but it has some democratic norms that it lives by. So we want the rise of China to come into a framework that is basically safe for the world. I hope the U.S. can do more than it is currently doing to manage the there's an income gap globally as well as domestically, and we should never take our eye off the problem of global poverty. Africa continues to grow in population at a very rapid rate. In 2050, 1 in 4 people on Earth will be African. We've talked a lot about migration problems this week, and there's a kind of core demographic problem underneath all of this, which is Europe is small and rich. It also has a pretty old population. Africa is big and poor, and they're not that far apart. And people from Africa, Tony Blinken mentioned the Dallas syndrome, how if you see a TV show like Dallas with a lot of rich people, you want some of that. So if young African migrants are trying to endanger their lives to make a little bit of money, very hard-earned money, low-paying jobs to support their mothers and fathers back in Africa, they're not bad people. They just want a chance to make a living, and we need to somehow figure that out. So I would say global poverty, restoring democratic norms domestically, and standing up for democracy internationally, especially with China in 2030.
Great, thank you. It's a great Winston Churchill quote. I mean, he is just a machine for these sorts of quotes. It's amazing. But he has a good quote on this exact topic, which is, democracy is the worst system, pause, except for all the others. Fundamentally, do you agree with that, or do you disagree with that? Do you think that?
I do agree with that. I'm an optimist. I just want us to pay really close attention. It's like an old car. You need to maintain it. And I think we've been a little lazy. We don't always even mean the same things when we say democracy. We need to bear down on what that term means. What are the 20 or 30 gear mechanisms that help a healthy democracy to function? And we probably need to teach it again. Many of you might have taken civics classes in the 40s and 50s, and I think that was a healthy exercise. They were phased out. I don't think I ever took one, but I'm trying to design a civics program for young people at the City University of New York, great public university. And maybe we probably want to do democracy training even younger, you know, like 8, 9, 10-year-olds. We want to get them before they're on their phones all the time. We also probably want to design apps that can do some of this work for us, but we want to bear down. But yes, I am an optimist, and I do agree with that great quote. He said that in a perfectly democratic setting. He was in a debate in Parliament in 1947. He was voted out with very little dignity in 1945, and then he continued to serve in Parliament, which was great. John Quincy Adams is the only president who went back to serve in the House. I believe Andrew Johnson served in the Senate after being president. I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see former presidents showing us how democracy works at a local level. Churchill said that in a parliamentary debate, and which was a perfect place to say it, and then he included some digs at the opposition, and a few lines after he said it, there are all these sort of parenthetical, the transcriber wrote, the opponents were saying, rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. What a great way to talk about democracy. So.
Right. So we're going to head into Q&A.
You've said that President Trump is a great politician. Is there evidence that he believes in or understands democracy?
Not much, no. It's a good question. One reason he does not go out there and articulate what democracy means to the world is it seems pretty clear he either doesn't understand or he doesn't approve. And if he is like these other strongmen whom he does seem to admire a lot, Putin, Kim in North Korea, I don't think he's praised Erdogan, but it feels similar. All of those guys want to stay in power forever. And I don't think he can pull that off. I don't think that's a real danger. I think the Democrats are probably going to win the House in November. Just knocked on wood for a second. I think it might be optimistic to think they would win the Senate. So we'll have a mixed government the way the founders wanted us to. Probably not very much will get done legislatively, but there will be very meaningful checks on Donald Trump, including if the Democrats win back the House, they will suddenly have the chairs of the House committees, which is actually very important, because then those committees can do robust investigating of what he's, like the threat of Russian collusion, the Mueller investigation will be much more protected. It doesn't feel that secure right now. And with the Democratic Congress, it will be much more secure, and those committees will have subpoena power. And so it'll be much harder for Donald Trump to get away with what he has gotten away with. And then 2020, who knows? We're in such an unpredictable time. But I think if he's had 2 years of very ineffective leadership, and like what we're seeing this week and last week, sort of the constant threat of shutdowns if he doesn't get the money for his wall, I think people will tire of that. He probably will not be reelected in 2020. He probably will accept that. But there are dangers, including the wag the dog scenario, in which he sees that he's losing power and he gets suddenly very interested in a military threat to a small country. And that would be terrifying.
Thank you very much for the great discussion. Given the dysfunction in Washington and in government and the extreme partisanship, what are your thoughts about whether a new system of our government, a true multi-party system here in the United States, would hinder or disrupt democracy?
That's a great question. Do we need a multi-party democracy or new parties? It has happened in our history a couple times. Lincoln was dealing with that in 1860 when he's elected. He's the first Republican elected. The party was only about 6 years old when he was elected. And I think most of us would look back and say that was a pretty healthy development that Abraham Lincoln came along with a new party. So we may do that again. And I'm not quite sure what the form of it would be. But if a lot of centrist Republicans got together with a lot of centrist Democrats, I don't think that would be a bad thing. I think that might be all right. But it's very hard to predict how that will happen. In many countries on Earth, there are multi-party democracies. But the creation of a new party can also be a bad thing, and we're seeing that in a lot of Europe. We're seeing a lot of, the word populist is used. It means different things in different moments of history, but these are sort of quasi-fascist white people parties. Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, and now, very disturbingly, Italy. You know, one of the core NATO countries and one of the core countries of humanism, it is the core country of the Renaissance, and where David Fisher told us about Greek and Roman democracy. We don't want Italy suddenly standing for, I guess it did stand for fascism in the 1930s, but we want to keep a sense of the values we all believe in. So I wouldn't be that troubled if we got some new parties. I don't think it has to be Democrats and Republicans forever, and I don't think the Republican Party is a very good party right now. I'd really like to see Republican Senate leadership, and we're not seeing very much. I don't think Democratic leadership of the Senate and House is all that great either, by the way. I think a lot of people just want some new leaders to step up. I think a lot of young people want that, especially.
All right, I'm going to do one more question.
Thank you very much. Given that free and fair elections are the foundation of democracy, what can we do as everyday citizens to protect voting rights?
It's a great question. That, might be the most important question outside of making sure we have a proper system of checks and balances at the highest level. Basically, we need checks on presidents. But we need to vote, and we're not very good at voting. We're in the middle of where well-developed economies, big wealthy countries. If you ask most Americans, where are we in how our democracy functions, they probably think we're like probably in the top 5 or 10 in our voting patterns. We're way down. We're, I think, around 30 or 40. We don't vote in very large numbers. Scandinavian countries vote much better than we do. And now we're seeing that even the way we vote is compromised. So there are a lot of fears of Russian infiltration of voting machines. So we need to regain confidence in our cybersecurity. And we had a really good talk from Nick Dowling about cybersecurity. But You need to walk into a voting booth and feel completely confident that your vote will actually be counted. And that has been a fear, not just with the Russian hacking, but in the year 2000, with that contested election. There was a kind of loss of confidence in voting, I think, that we haven't fully rebounded from. And so there are lots of political science experts on how to vote. And there are, you can vote by mail, which is a very interesting red state innovation of the moment in Utah. Utah, which is a very red state, and an interesting state. They take democracy very seriously in Utah, and they're allowing voting and registration by mail to get their registration numbers up. It's actually a pretty democratic idea coming from a red state, but another red state is Alabama, and they're terrible. They're always coming up with ways to disenfranchise basically the poor, the elderly, and the African American, because those groups historically vote Democrat. So Alabama just is always tinkering with the system in bad ways. But we should, you know, as part of civics education, study voting, look around the world. It's not very hard. Who votes well? How can we imitate? So some countries pay, you get assigned a small financial penalty if you don't vote. I believe Chile does that. And you might suddenly get a lot more voting if you pay a $20 fine if you don't vote. And really, we should vote every time there's a local election. You know, one thing I've really appreciated being on this island is the island takes care of itself. People really care. They don't care so much what political party you're from, but they do care what island you live on. And if you're running out of firewood in the winter, you know how to get some. There's a great book on Will's bookshelf by Charles W. Eliot, the president of Harvard 100 years ago, about an islander named John Gilley and what a good life he led. He took care of his neighbors and they took care of him. And if we can get that Mount Desert Island sensibility back, we may not be as deserted as I'm afraid we are going to be. So.
Thanks very much, Ted.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was historian Ted Widmer on the question, is democracy failing? He recently spoke at the 2018 Champlain Institute, hosted by College of the Atlantic. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock and Mogwai. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.